Monocle is serving up its own brand new food and drink title, and its editor will be here to break bread and share some secrets. The brains behind a magazine taking rugby from the sports pages to the independent newsstand will stop by to tell us why the time is now for the sport. And it's always just the right moment to hear from the team at Serial. Rosa Parks stewards that particular magazine ship, and she'll be dropping anchor here today on The Stack. From Midori House in London, this is The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis, with me, Tom Edwards. A premium magazine about rugby and a preview of the Monocle Drinking and Dining directory ahead. But we start the show with Serial, the influential biannual travel, design, art and style magazine. Founded in 2012 by Rosa Park, the title's been hugely influential. They just launched issue 15. I have it here, and it's a thing of beauty indeed. To tell us more about it and about the history of Serial, it's an absolute delight to welcome back to our studios, Rosa Park. Rosa, good to have you with us again. We were just talking, actually, before we started. 6 years.
Yeah,
on
it's wild.
Since first we spoke. And what a journey, because that was obviously you right at the beginning of the Serial story, really.
Yep.
The empire has flourished. How would you, and it's an impossible question in a way, but how would you sum up the interim? Quite a lot. It's been busy.
It's been really busy. I always feel that there's this dichotomy of time moving very, very quickly and time seemingly moving very slowly. You know that feeling when you think 6 years, that sounds like a long time. It certainly feels like a long time. But it feels like yesterday when I started Serial Volume 1, you know? So it's kind of concurrent in my mind. But it has been the most interesting 6 years of my life.
There we go. Understatement award. Definitely secured. But just tell me a bit about that, because I always ask, particularly sort of our returning friends of the programme, about the process of evolution, their kind of growth, and what are the most instructive things. You know, we like this show in a way to be a bit of a primer, maybe for someone who's about to start their own magazine or who's just embarked on that journey. Is there no substitute for the doing? There's no shortcuts, are there? Or do you think there are things that maybe you might, knowing now, you might change even your approach at the outset?
I think there are definitely no shortcuts. Some people may disagree, but my belief is that there are none. And if you take some thinking there are, perhaps you will not end up in the place that you thought you would, whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. Every day I feel like I'm still learning, going to school. I don't think that feeling ever goes away, no matter how many years you do this. And the growth has been organic. And I know everybody uses that word, organic growth. But I say that in the most purest sense because whether people believe it or not, I didn't have a business plan when I started Serial. It started as this intense passion, almost whimsy. I was serious about it, but I knew so little that I didn't know what to be afraid of. I didn't know what to look out for. I kind of went into it blind. And that came with pros and cons. I think the pro was that I had no fear. So I was like, right, let's do this. Let's try everything. And it was very trial and error.
That definitely sort of resonates. And I think a number of our guests actually talk about how empowering fearlessness can be.
Yeah.
But I guess people will look at this and say, well, you know, we're up to what, volume 15, and we'll talk about the beautiful new edition in a moment. But there's also the guidebooks, there's a sort of creative agency, there's all the rest of it that goes with it. Maybe people say, well, hang on, the lack of a business plan, the letting my passion lead me, that can only surely take you so far.
Yeah.
Is it a question of balancing that or marrying that up with the constraints of then running what becomes you know, quite a big, busy and dynamic business?
The passion gets you going, but it only gets you going. You really have to learn very quickly on the job what you have to do to survive. And that's kind of what I meant when I said it's like going to school every single day, because if I don't figure it out, if I don't figure out a plan, a game plan, some sort of business strategy quickly enough, then I don't think we would be here 6 years in and still growing. So first of all, the magazine began as this big passion, but very quickly after the first year, we started thinking about how do we generate revenue to sustain this business and hire people. And so the advertising kicked in after year one. There was no advertising in the first year. And it was never because we didn't want it. It was because we couldn't get any. So I want to be very honest about that. And when we got to year one and got our circulation up, that's when we made our dream list of all the brands that we wanted as advertisers, started approaching them. I hired an advertising manager. once that ball got rolling, and then it became about, okay, how do we raise our circulation in a way that makes sense to us? And as that goes up, your advertising goes up. So I think it feeds each other. And then soon after that, brands were approaching us saying, hey, we like your look. Can you do it for us? And we ran with that opportunity and started taking client projects. And we very quickly responded to that need and also hired more people to help us with that. That's what I mean. I think even though there was no plan, as soon as opportunities presented themselves, we made sure that we got ready to just run with it.
Well, let me ask you a bit about that idea about the look, you know, brands saying, oh, we like it. And I think in a way, I don't know if this delights you or appalls you or maybe neither. I'm sure people say to you, or you overhear people saying, oh, you know, the serial look.
Yeah.
And it's very much, it's part of, there's been this amazing boom in independent publishing, and it's all obviously born up in that. But the magazine has retained definitely a very clear visual sort of identity. There's that, the cleanness, the strip back. It's about the strength of the image, the strength of the writing. Has that been easy? Or does the sort of purity of that vision, does that ever come under pressure as a business like this grows and adds other dimensions? And I guess as you have to delegate stuff, decision making to other people a bit.
I think that the purity is always challenged in every business. It's inevitable. And, you know, I am the editor-in-chief. Of course, my co-founder and partner, Richard, is the creative director. And I think that we work very well as a team because over time, we've slipped into these very different roles where my primary focus, first and foremost, is obviously to create the story, the narrative, the words. And on top of that, I do the role of publisher. So I'm looking after the business interest in terms of advertising and sales. But he has a role where his main responsibility is to maintain the visual direction of the brand. And I think he understands that that is a very big part of who we are, and it's how people recognize us. So if we don't protect it and take care of it, then he believes that we would jeopardize our business. So, you know, I think that he is definitely a purist. I know that everybody kind of seems to outdo one another in terms of, oh, you know, but really, I can't stress it enough. He, to this day, goes to press for every issue and sits there from the moment the first pages start printing to all the way to the end. He can't leave. He has to make sure that it's perfect. Every single photograph that is posted on our social media is vetted by Rich, and he can't let that element go, even though we could very easily hire a social media manager. He believes every photograph you put out into the world from Serial has to reflect that ethos. Otherwise, you very quickly lose ground.
They're a funny breed, creative directors, aren't they?
Yep.
saying nothing more than that. Let's dive into the volume 15, of course. This is the Spring-Summer 2018 edition. A thing of beauty, as always. Now, a couple of things that jumped out at me. Yeah. There's a great piece, The Master Plan, and this is about Tadeo Ando. Maybe you could just tell us about that, because for me, that is, could almost be a quintessentially Serial story told, photographed in a way that just feels like it's can only be on these pages.
Yeah. You know, I think I would actually agree with you. That was one of my favorite stories of the issue for many different reasons. I mean, through the evolution of Serial, I've realized that we are a travel magazine and we use the word travel as a lens. So perhaps we're no longer covering as much conventional travel content. And in fact, we're covering a lot of architecture and design and art, but always through a travel lens. Because when you go to France or, you know, the States, what are you actually doing? You're looking for museums, you're looking for galleries. Well, I certainly am. And this story where we interviewed Tadeo Ando is on Chateau Lacoste, which is a beautiful vineyard in the south of France, and it also has galleries and museums and a hotel and restaurant, and it kind of mixes all of the things that we're the most passionate about. It has food, it has the vineyards and therefore the landscape, it has the architecture, it has all of these elements. And the first person that we wanted to interview was Tadeo Ando, because he created the framework in which all of these elements exist. Mm. And to then speak to him about how does the landscape inform your work? And then how does your architectural work then inform the art and the experience? And it allowed us to get into a dialogue about all of these layers that you are constantly being exposed to that perhaps you're not aware of all the time when you're drinking wine and looking at a painting. But we're diving into that and kind of, revealing that to our readership.
Let's look a little to the future, Ezra, because you tantalise me with this idea that there could be some changes ahead. Only ever evolutions, I'm sure, not revolutions. Yeah. But tell us a bit about not only what you're planning, but why the time is now to do that.
Yes, so I mentioned that we are completely redesigning the internal pages of Serial. The cover design will remain the same. And our readers will know that we, in fact, redesign relatively often compared to other titles. I think every 2 years there's been tweaks to our design. And, you know, they're never dramatic. You're not looking at this magazine and go, whoa, well, they're not serial anymore. It's always iterations. But we like to do that because I think that we do it because we know we're not abandoning our core values or our core look. It's just more a simple refresh. And I think that whilst the cover has undergone multiple changes, the internal page is not as much. So I just felt it's time. Let's revisit. And actually, we're revisiting it much more than just design in the sense, at this point in time, our magazine is divided into sections. So you have an entire section dedicated to specific regions, to certain themes, but we're actually going to make it a little bit more loose. And I've asked our designers to redesign, but also completely rethink the flow of the editorial, which is going to be really interesting for me to see, because now I've invited these two people to come in and review everything that we've done and present me with what they think we should do, and then we'll take it from there.
They like a challenge, designers.
Yes.
They'll rise to it, I'm quite certain. And just a kind of a bigger picture thing, and I've been talking to a few, again, friends, particularly people who we haven't spoken to on the show for a while, about the mood, not just, I guess, in the publishing business, but the mood more generally in the sort of in the country. Plenty's changed, it's safe to say, since we last spoke here. Yeah. In the UK. You guys are based in the west of England, of course. Yeah. Still feels like home, still feels like a good place to be working. There's lots of weird political storms brewing and passing over this country at the moment. You still feel like this is the right place to be doing Serial? I mean,
yes.
I don't know. The creative industries, it's interesting.
Yeah.
In a way, they can be more fleet of foot. You know, people can say, well, no, actually, we're going to go and be based in Berlin or in Gothenburg or in Copenhagen or whatever it might be.
Yeah.
Does that ever cross your mind?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's something that we talk about all the time, especially between Rich and I. You know, where should we live? Where should we be based? Is this the right home for us? And I can't believe it, but I've been in the southwest of England for 8 years, which blows my mind. But, you know, there you go. Almost a decade. Readers of Serial will also know from my last editor's letter in volume 14 that I had very, very big visa problems, which, you know, it caused a lot of upset and frustration at the time. Now that it is more or less behind me, I've definitely calmed down about it. But here's what I think. Without getting too overly political.
We don't mind that. Go for it, Rosa. It's fine.
Well, for me, let's just say that where you are is not really as important to me as it might be for some. I've moved around my whole life. I've never felt that one particular place is a home. So even now, yes, I am based in Bath, but I mean, out of the month, I'm there maybe half. You know, so I live there. It's my base. I love it. It's peaceful. It's beautiful. I'm super happy to have Serial base there. Do I think that's forever? I don't know. Am I open to going somewhere else? Absolutely.
There you go. Get your bids in now, I guess. Yeah. Is the message from that. Rosa, it's so great to speak with you as always. Congrats on volume 15. We can hardly wait for what will await us in volume 16 now.
Thank you.
The appetite's whetted. Do come back and see us again.
Will do. Thanks for having me.
A change of pace now. Something we've never ever discussed here on The Stack is rugby. Not the market town in Warwickshire, although we haven't talked about that either, but the sport itself. It's becoming one of the most popular around the world, so it surely deserves a premium title about it and the stories that surround it. Hence, we now have rugby. In their first issue, they covered topics as diverse as a rugby president tackling Swaziland's HIV crisis to a small-town rugby club in the Czech Republic. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco spoke to rugby's founder and editor, Alex Mead.
Alex Mead, a pleasure to have you here at Monocle 24 on The Stack. And I have to say, Alex, I'm not a connoisseur of the world of rugby, but I have to say I really enjoyed your magazine. Do you think, first of all, there was a gap in the market for a more premium publication about the sport?
Yeah, I think so. I think the way in which sort of the world of content has worked, that people now are kind of almost craving a sort of an experience they can get engaged with for a longer period of time. Look at how podcasts, so everyone loves them because they get lost in it. And I think Word still does the same thing. And I think with rugby, there's so many amazing characters, so many amazing people, and it's as much about the stories behind them. You know, it's about digging a bit deeper, but also being able to give something 10 pages of beautiful photos and the words that it means to get the story across in the best way. So So I think everything else was so about the immediate. Everything was about getting excited about the Six Nations, the World Cup, what's happening this weekend. Whereas this was for these sort of bigger reads that can go a little bit further, really.
And Alex, another thing that I've noticed in the magazine, you make sure to keep it quite international. So it's not like a very local, only about, you know, the British rugby players. You do, for example, there's a profile of a rugby president who is tackling the HIV crisis in Swaziland. There's a Jamaican player heavily featured on Rugby Issue 2. So it was that your intention to be a very quite international rugby publication?
I think it's just reflective of how the world in general is now. I mean, if you look at the origins of all the rugby players, you know, people, and the funny thing is, people say, look at different names. They're, oh, that's not an English name. But now this is the second generation of players that are coming through from the professionalism. It was their dads that came over here. They were born here or they grew up here. So they're as English as anyone. And I think it's just reflective of the industry. And the rugby world is actually a very small place. Everyone kind of knows everyone. Everyone's sort of linked. And I think it's just where the stories come from. It's not being an intentional to say, let's go here, let's tick all the boxes. What are the great stories and where do they come from? And I think the rugby diaspora is incredibly close. So when there's a good story, it kind of gets around. And people have been coming to us. I mean, that's been the great thing. Originally, we work in rugby a lot anyway, as I work with Eric. And I think the stories have just, they just emerge, in all honesty. And we choose the ones that are the most interesting, that we think have got the most depth to them, and sort of go from there, really.
When did you decide, you know, to launch such a publication? Were you a rugby player, or did you used to play, or you just kind of enjoy to watch on the telly?
I've always played at a terrible level. I love it. I love it. I think the only thing that's ever stopped me really pushing to try to be a full-time rugby journalist was always the fact I love playing. Even at a social level, terrible level, I play for a local club. This season, I actually started, I was coaching and I was playing still, but as a result of deciding to launch the rugby magazine, I'm not able to. But I think it was just the company I work for, Eric, all of our work's digital and we wanted to do something a bit more tangible. And it felt like, I've always loved rugby. I grew up here. I'm from the West Country. It's just what we do in the West Country. I always felt there was something missing and I felt this was the gap. And I figured, let's do it just because we can, really. I think we had an opportunity. We knew we had a certain audience, so let's just try. The first one came out in December. We'd managed to scrabble together enough money to get the first issue out, because when it's that sort of size, it's quite expensive to print. We put a few hundred up for sale and they all went. And so we figured, oh, we've got something. And it was the response on social media to the magazine. People were taking pictures of it on their coffee table. One person did a whole video with the magazine. I mean, it was just, and we don't know these people. They're not even relations or anything. And they were putting this stuff up there. So we were so excited. We thought, we've got something. So again, we got together enough money to get a second issue out. It's literally just arrived. So we'll see how this one goes.
You have issue two in front of me. That means, you know, the first issue did very well. Do you have any kind of a business plan, or are you starting with subscriptions? Are you selling newsstands? How is it working now?
I would love to say this wasn't driven by passion, but it is driven by passion, but also knowing, being so involved in the rugby world, that the response makes me think that's how it worked. But we do have a kind of plan behind it. You can now subscribe to the magazine. So we needed to get to the second one so that you could subscribe. So we got to the second one. You can now subscribe. It's going to be quarterly. We're looking at how we can do extra bits of content beyond it, whether that's choosing some of the stories to do a sort of podcast with or videos with beyond it. The heart of it is always going to be this print journal that's timeless. One of the people who actually advertised rang us up and said, out of the blue, he was the owner of the company, and said, look, I just wanted something to read on a Sunday afternoon. That's all he wanted. And they've advertised and it's brilliant. And we hope more people will get on board because it is unique. And in terms of engagement, it's how long people do. That each article is like 3,000 words, you know, on average. I think we put 40,000 words into one issue, which is basically a book. But we checked every story. Every story was read. Our chief sub-editor knows nothing about rugby. No, absolutely nothing. She actually works in the world of food. And we wanted her to find them interesting. So every story is as much about the place and the story behind that person, so it can engage them. Just, you don't have to be a rugby fan to enjoy it.
Talking about food, there's a lovely feature on issue one, the diary of what a rugby player eats. Mm. And it's quite a strict diet, right? If you want to follow it, it can be quite hard.
Incredibly. Like, and I think that was also part of it. We've often seen these, right now there's so many different diets that are kicking around. And when you look at what the rugby players have to do, one of the relief of them, you speak to ex-rugby players and they say that they love the fact they don't have to eat as much anymore. And you can see them shrink in size. You look at some of the guys, within a few years, a lot of them have dropped right down. And it's because they don't have to keep the level of protein up they had to before in order to maintain the mass they had to play for the game.
Do you also read other rugby publications, or even do you follow the broadsheet?
I read coverage? Everything. I like, you know, there's a weekly paper out there that I like reading because I like looking at the old results from my old teams, you know, from Devon. I like that side of things. There aren't a massive amount of publications. You know, you'll always read The Telegraph, you'll always read The Guardian, you look at what The Times does, and you look at all these different bits and pieces and you just collect them. But it's social as well now. I love the fact there's about 5 or 6 different podcasts. I love the fact everyone's getting very territorial. There's like, there was one gossip columnist at one point and everyone wasn't sure about gossip. No, we don't have gossip in rugby. We need that stuff because that's what keeps everyone talking about it all year round. Now there's several gossip columnists. The first gossip columnist doesn't like it, but we all need it. There should be several of everything. We should all be talking about this sport to get it bigger because we're not the biggest. We're not football. So if we're going to spread this, we need several magazines. We need all these different podcasts. We need all these different newspapers because all of us are searching out these stories and celebrating the great game. So I don't think it's any one or anything. I mean, you know, sports wise, obviously I like Sports Illustrated that you don't tend to sort of see over here. That South African Sports Illustrated was great for rugby. New Zealand Rugby World, I always used to get. New Zealand Rugby News was always great because I used to always follow the NPC down there. So quite international as well. There was one called Inside Rugby in Australia, which I'm not sure if it still exists, but that was always great. So internationally, the only magazine I've seen similar to us, there is an Italian rugby magazine, I think, which is a bit more stylized, a bit more fashion as well, which is sort of quite beautiful. But to be honest, it's everything. We need the other rugby magazines. We need the other podcasts. We need everything together to just celebrate the sport, really.
That was Alex Mead from Rugby Magazine talking to Fernando. And now to end the programme, a little preview of a new Monocle title that will be on all good newsstands imminently, from next week in fact. The Monocle Drinking and Dining Directory is on its way. Who better to tell us more than the editor behind it, the Eminence Grease, or Grease perhaps that should be in this context, Josh Fennett, and here he is.
And what an introduction, Tom. It's probably not clear to listeners the amount that you gesture while you're doing this, but it's a fitting introduction nonetheless, and an exciting new title in prospect. Lots of culinary morsels, saucy opinions, and a few tidbits.
Bit of sauce. But just tell us, how does this fit into the big picture? Because obviously you're the food and travel editor. You cover great dining establishments, people who've mastered the art of hospitality on the printed page in Monocle anyway. Why is there sort of expansion into this area? What do you feel and what did the team feel that could do with that extra focus?
Well, we just think that people spend so much time talking and thinking about food, and maybe there was a bit of a gap in the market where the coverage wasn't, I don't want to say serious, because none of the stories that we've covered are, you know, overtly earnest or po-faced, but I just want to say, like, a good bit of reporting about food and what's going on in the world, and, like, to kind of creep down the corridors of some places that you don't get access to otherwise.
I've spoken to you about doing that all the time, Josh.
I know, and I'm looking to address it, but I've got a little array. The printed magazine arrives imminently into the office, but I've done some printouts of stories, and as you can see, the idea was to mix up what the Monocle format was, so it's the same size, but we've flipped the cover to make it white instead of black and give it a new sense of something different on the newsstand. So it'll sit next to the international titles, but it's about 2/3 gloss, which is very different from the uncoated stock that we use in the magazine, which is perhaps better suited to telling more serious stories, different types of reportage that can be to do with politics or global affairs. We thought food just deserved it. You know, we do go to some unusual places, but we've set it out in Plantin in this kind of beautiful, reserved way, and we've let the pictures do the talking.
You know, people who are familiar with our coverage of food and drink, and indeed hospitality more broadly, hotels, the works, will understand that, yeah, sure, you need to do a great job. You need to provide a great service, but we're not that interested in the, as you said earlier, the po-faced, the over-serious, even really the too sort of scientific. There needs to be some warmth that kind of pervades it. Was it very important in terms of the sort of editorial positioning of this new project that there was that levity? I mean, you've talked about it already, but it's not just a question of putting a few puns in there, but there are some good ones.
Yeah, there's a few puns in there, but I think what we've tried to do is we've tried to select stories that speak to the core values of what we think food and drink coverage is at its best. Not obsessed with novelty, so you're thumbing there rather rudely as I talk the coverage of an amazing story about the young entrepreneurs turning the tables, if you'll excuse the pun, on the dying culture of tabernas, which are kind of the living rooms of Madrid as a city, where people go, old and young. The first glasses of wine, you know, tumble out of the bottles at about 11, and the place doesn't shut till 2 or 3. You know, it's where the old folks go to talk about politics, and it's where increasingly a young generation who stayed at home, who didn't have the opportunity to travel abroad, have turned their hand to reviving these kind of amazing, colourful, tiled, beautiful, communal spaces in the city. So it's doing two things. It's if you want to go to Madrid, you can see these great tavernas. There's a great piece of photography you've got to open on a page, which is a kind of communal table. We've given a full page to that because it's so beautiful. The story's over, you know, 16 pages of gloss. In one sense, it's consumer journalism. Yeah, you can go there and you can try it. But in another sense, it's speaking to a way in which the way we eat, the way we consume food, the way we interact in restaurants is changing as well. So all of these things have a little bit of a political push as well. Just one other story I'd like to mention, which I think speaks very well to this, is a story we did called Restaurants Through the Ages. And this was an idea that I've just been obsessed with for a little while, but I wanted to get the right mix of restaurants. And it's talking to a place that opened in New York a year or two ago, a place that opened in London around 5 years ago, and Melbourne 10 years ago. And it goes all the way up to, you know, 50 years ago in Vienna. Peter Fries, who's been in charge of Zum Schwarz und Kamel for such a long time. And we asked them, you know, what would you tell yourself when you were starting out if you know what you know now? What are the most important things? And there's practical advice there about how your turnover and your profit need to relate to one another, about trying things and not taking off lunch service if it's not making you any money. But there's also great insights into the way that restaurants have needed to adapt to our expectations of them. And our subtle point there is that the best restaurants are rarely the newest ones, and they're certainly not the ones you've heard of and you need to queue around the block for 2 days to get a seat at.
Josh, it's a beautiful thing indeed. Just remind people when it's out, where they can find out more. I don't know. Also, is this going to have other iterations? Are we going to... I feel like you need to have one of those sort of chefy travelogue programs. Fennet on food or something.
Where it's just me laying on top of a...
driving around like some kind of motorised pie around the countryside or something. I don't know what it would look like exactly.
You've got a very firm image in your head and I'm not obliged to dislodge it.
It's quite a soft pie, actually.
Yeah, so it's going to be an annual issue. So every spring, forthwith, it'll be out on all good newsstands, I believe, at the end of next week, and winging its way to subscribers as we speak.
Wonderful stuff. Well, Josh, congrats. I think it looks brilliant and I can't wait to see the finished article when it arrives. And that's all we have time for on this week's programme. Thanks to our producer, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our editors, Cassie Galpin and George McDonough. Comments or queries are, of course, welcome. Drop a note to Fernando. You'll find him on fp@monocle.com. And don't forget to join us at the same time next week. This is The Stack. I'm Tom Edwards. Thank you very much for listening.